The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 17, 2015. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all. Well, today I thought, continuing with the series we've had started with David Loy being here, and we began talking about our practice in relation to the environment, really, and the issue of global warming. And I think a number of things have come up already as a result of this in the discussions we've had. And, I thought I heard at some point, in fact, I thought it was a couple of Wednesdays ago, where I missed because of somebody I had to meet with. I missed part of the Wednesday presentation, and I thought it was there that I heard the question being raised, a question of whether or not we're natural. And I asked Cynthia about that, if that was a question that was raised. She said no, so apparently that wasn't. But I swear, somewhere I heard this question come up, and there was some discussion about it. Was that?
I could tell you what the question was. It was whether or not humans are exceptional. I think that's...
Yes, I think so. And that might have triggered enough, because I heard part of the discussion when I got down there a little late. And I might have interpreted it in that way. But I swear somewhere I actually heard the term natural being discussed. And, of course, the question is, we're talking about global warming at the hands of people, human beings. Have we done something to the environment, to the atmosphere, to alter things? Or is this just a natural occurrence of some kind? And then the question, but I swear, someone, well, even if I didn't hear this, it's an interesting question. I'm going to bring it up because that's the talk I'm going to give today. So you're stuck with it. Unless this peters off very quickly, and then we can have a discussion. I don't know. Anyway, but it's an interesting question. This question of aren't we natural? Because if we're natural, then whatever it is that we do is natural. And of course, we're part of the environment. And then it's only natural that as human beings evolved, creatures like us, we come along, and eventually we're going to use the environment in such a way. Inevitably, we're going to be dumping a bunch of carbon into the atmosphere and raising the global temperature, etc. Okay, so that's the question. And then we can discuss endlessly about this term, natural. And what does that even mean? And we do stuff like this. I can remember being in debates and talks about stuff like this for years, decades, way back to my early college days, at least. And what I can recall about any kind of discussion like this that I've ever gotten into is that there's no resolution, and it's just arguing and arguing. You know, it's kind of like, arguing about that question, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? And apparently this must be a real fun one because it's been with us a long time, and people will raise this kind of a question. And we can debate endlessly about, well, is that sound or not? What is sound? What would we call it? Is it just the vibrations in the air, or is it, the wiggling of the eardrum, or the electrical impulses to the brain, etc.? And we can debate and argue endlessly about this. I like Suzuki's answer to this question when somebody asked about that. He said, it doesn't matter. The tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? It doesn't matter. And just quickly put that to an end. But we will bring up stuff like this. Like, for example, we could, say, talk about entropy, which is a technical term, but don't worry about it. It just means the amount of disorder in a system of any kind. And we can make a simple little system here. I could have brought in, Steve would have done something like this, where he'd bring in Demonstrate here for you or something, but you're just going to have to imagine this. I'm too cheap or something. I don't. But say if I brought in a couple of buckets of golf balls, and they're all just mixed, red and green, colored golf balls. And then two other empty buckets, and then I just ask you to put the green ones over here and the red ones over there. And so as I sat them down, and there's just a bunch of red and green golf balls, and this would be a very chaotic and disordered system, we could say. And the question is to make it more ordered, you know, to lower the entropy, and that would be to put the red ones over here and the green ones over there. And of course, this might be fine. And we say once we have all the red are in this bucket and the green are over here, and we say, well, okay, this has low entropy. This is a well-ordered system. Except if somebody were, or if you happen to be, say, colorblind, and you really can't make the distinction between red and green, and say the hues and the values of these two colors are so much the same that they just look the same to you. Now you don't know, you know, what, you know, we don't know where to put it. So then the question is, okay, so this disorder in the system, is it actually in the world out there? To one person, you'll see order. To another person, what are you talking about? I don't see any distinction here at all. Of course, then we could say, well, you know, but it really is that way because these are really green and those are, you know. And, no. Because color doesn't actually exist out there in the world. Do you know that? There isn't anything that actually, things might have a kind of a value, you know, lighter or darker and that sort of thing. But color? No, actually we don't have that at all. In fact, you think, well, I can see orange or yellow or whatever. But actually, you know, whatever it is, you look, the flower or whatever, just no orange or yellow. So where is this occurring? And then we can sit there and say, well, like the different color is like in the eye, we have different sensors. But actually, you don't have a sensor for orange or yellow in your eye. We just have sensors. We have tissue there that gets excited if, say, red light falls on it. Red or green or blue. These are sending signals, but these signals are all the same. Sending them to the brain. And then we say, well, then in the brain somewhere, this all gets sorted out. And by mixing them in various ways, we end up seeing all the colors, provided you have all three of those sensors. And we'll talk like this. But then we get back to that question of entropy. How do we resolve that? And of course, that isn't really resolved, nor is this issue of color resolved. Now, where is the color? So is it in your brain? And we could go on endlessly like this and discuss these kinds of things with no really comfortable resolution of any kind whatsoever. As Suzuki Roshi says, you know, in the end, doesn't matter. You know, does this constitute sound or not? What exactly are we going to call sound? And it really doesn't matter. Well, same thing with this question. Natural, or is it really the same? So we want to talk about, well, what is natural here? And if we start to discuss this, we will end up talking endlessly and debating endlessly. We'll each have maybe our different ideas about, well, what that term means, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we can argue endlessly about it. And to the extent that we might grasp onto a particular viewpoint, we don't really hang on to that. When we come up against somebody else who's holding to a different interpretation, well, of course, this can very easily lead to conflict and anger and hatred, all sorts of things going on. We easily fall into things like this as human beings. What I want to say about this term natural is it the same as when Suzuki Roshi said about the sound? He didn't say about color, but we could have gone on the same way. Doesn't matter. Well, maybe something like that matters if you're a physicist and you're trying to develop some kind of a sensor for whatever. Okay, fine. But even there, ultimately, where is the color? Where is the sound? What constitutes the sound? Same thing here about this matter of natural. Here we are. We naturally occurred here on this planet, it would seem. We evolved. And here we are now, we've evolved this capacity through our wonderful human minds and stereoscopic vision and a opposable thumbs and all this sort of thing, we can do a lot of manipulating of the planet. And it seems like we're doing things now that are putting not only us, but pretty much all of life on this planet in peril in one way or another. And but then, is this natural? And we can easily get lost in a debate about this, discussing this. And maybe when Suzuki wrote, she said, well, it doesn't matter. Maybe in this case, maybe it does matter. At least maybe it matters that we get some sense of what's at stake here in terms of seeing, waking up to reality or missing it. And this is what the Buddha's concern was. He did resolve this for us. What's really important in this particular situation? Yeah, like sound, color, this sort of thing. Okay, does that really matter? Well, in apart from some limited application, no, it doesn't really matter. And even there, you won't settle actually what it is. But here, there seems to be something at stake here that is huge. Even the survival of our own species. Are we confused about this issue in some way that can be cleared up, that won't just endlessly get lost in debate and argument and this sort of thing? Grasping a particular view as opposed to another? Well, actually there is. And the Buddha identified this. And this goes right to the very heart of his awakening. And do you know what it is? What we're talking about here is human activity, you know, how we carry on, the fact that we have these incredible minds and this incredible ability to manipulate the world around us. And of course, with our thinking, applying, you know, all of this. This is what we're talking about, is activity, action. And do you know what it is that the Buddha recognized about this?
Karma.
Karma. Yeah, karma. But we better say something about karma, especially if you haven't heard me talk about karma. Most of you have heard me, because we don't have a clear understanding of what this means, karma. In our culture today, you know, we tend to think something like the result of karma, karma vipaka. Karma just means action, and that's what we're talking about, action, action or activity. What the Buddha noticed about this, you know, and we're not talking about something else now. We're not talking about the results of action. That's where we normally go when we speak of karma. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not what the Buddha spoke of. He was just talking about karma. But he spoke of karma. The word literally means action. That's all it means. But he spoke of it, when he used the term karma, he was talking about willed action. And this is the difference. And it has some bearing on the kind of problem that we're looking at, that we've been looking at over the last few weeks. So I just want to move this into the picture, because as I said, I think somewhere, I could be totally mistaken, but I think, I thought I heard people debating and arguing in a group somewhere about this matter of, well, we're natural, and aren't we, you know, so whatever action we take, as if maybe that's excusable or something. But there is a difference here, and it is a subtle difference that the Buddha identified, and it makes all the difference in the world. In fact, it is the only difference that can be found, I would say, ultimately. So in that sense, maybe we could say, well, this does matter. It does matter if our concern is with human suffering. Now, this does matter. if our concern is with dukkha, with pain and confusion, and acting in ways that only increase or at least extend or continue the kind of pain and suffering and confusion we bring upon ourselves just through our own action. And I'm not speaking just about destroying the environment or something like that. I'm talking about just our interaction with each other, even in our personal interactions, let alone armies going to war and stuff like that. So there is something here, I think, that is of some importance, if these things are of concern to you. And it really is this matter of either living out of awakeness or not. Or as the Buddha put it, I teach but two things. There's dukkha and there's release from dukkha. Okay, if we're not living out of awakeness, out of a direct seeing and realization of reality, then we're going to be caught in various ways that are, well, they're dukkha. It's pain, suffering, confusion. And the same thing applies here. And so when it comes to this matter then, and we can, again, we could debate and argue endlessly as if this were a valid argument, as to whether or not we're natural or not. Or the things that we do, are these natural, and that sort of thing. But that kind of a question is what I would call an FEQ. You know, a flat earth question. You know, flat earth. If you believe the earth is flat, you know, you're going to have all kinds of questions about that. You know, does it just go on forever? Or, you know, we have all kinds of questions. But the questions that we will come up with have nothing to do with reality. They're all formed out of our ideas about how we think reality is. And if we end up getting caught up in arguments about, well, are we natural or not, and this sort of thing, we're going to end up just creating a lot of FEQs, flat earth questions, you know, meaningless questions that won't settle the issue, and we perpetuate our confusion, and we just go on. We're very good at this. We do this endlessly. And all the while, we're going to just be missing the simple reality, the truth that is right before us all the time. And it gets back to this matter that the Buddha identified. Are we acting out of will, out of some kind of desire to bring about particular ends? Now, if you consider, and you know, we talk about natural, like as if what? Are we talking about nature? Well, look at nature. Is nature intending to do anything? It's also easy for us, and ancient people have done, well, probably many people today, see intention in nature. You see the clouds passing over, and we think, well, they intend to go somewhere. You know, the waves beat on the shore, and we think, well, the waves, they want to caress the shore. They love the shore. They just, you know, they want to, you know. But of course, the next person might interpret that, well, no, the waves want to push the shore away, you see. And there we go. And it's easy for us to get caught up in this way. And again, we might have a hard time understanding what is natural. But with what nature, if we just look at it carefully and dispassionately, we can begin to see that actually nature doesn't intend to do anything. The actions of the natural world are coming out of the whole. One of the things that's characteristic of wholeness is chaos, or this unordered activity, out of which all sorts of things will appear to generate order in various ways. And so we see the various forms that are occurring and the developments and the evolution of things in nature that are occurring naturally, but none of it is driven by will or intent or design, we could say. Even though the things that are resulting from this will have that appearance, perhaps, about it. Or we can easily read that into it. And we do. But to the awakened, and what the Buddha identified here, he said that those who are awake, Buddhas, in other words, They do not act out of will, out of intent, out of trying to bring about some particular ends in regards to this or that. That is not their fundamental activity. Their activity is in just simply watching this and basically taking steps to avoid this. The Buddha said to do what is wholesome, to do what is comes out of the whole, out of totality, not out of your small self, not out of your own selfish desires to bring about particular ends in regard to me and how I'd like to have things go, where we normally are. The Buddha said to do what is wholesome without regard to your own personal stuff, to avoid what is unwholesome. What is caught up in the fractured world, the divided world of this and that, where you want to favor this over that? If you start to do this and you play with that and you start to push things and move things in that direction, you're going to have, well, the kind of problems that we're creating here on Earth with global warming, for example. But all sorts of other kinds of painful things, even within your own personal dealings with others and with your surroundings. And so on every scale, you know, we get ourselves completely caught up in this sort of thing. Because the basis of our action and our understanding and our desire is coming out of what I want for me, this fractured and separated thing here as we imagine it, even though in reality there is no such thing as that. We don't actually find anything truly separated like that. That's the problem. But as we keep wanting to go in a particular way, okay, and then I suppose we could say then that this is not natural action. We're applying this idea then of nature in a radically different way. Though it's probably best to just avoid that term altogether, I would say, because we can easily slip off and lose track of what's the issue here, and it has to do with this matter of will or intent or seeing yourself as some isolated and separated thing that now needs protection and it needs to be pleased. And that becomes the motivation of everything that we say and do. And there we are. So this is what the Buddha identified. And he said, this is what the awakened teach. This is the heart of it. Here it is right here, to do what is wholesome, to act and speak out of the whole, not out of just some petty concern for yourself. But out, and if to the extent that you need to act and speak, and you do, just see if you can just keep this in mind. It doesn't mean now to get ideas about that, because once again, that's introducing the fractured world. And to avoid those things that are set off and so easily get into opposition with other, where there's just some contention there and struggle. Just watch out for these things. And of course, even if you are acting out of wholeness, there could be somebody else who has a particular agenda here, and whatever it is, the action you might be taking or whatever, they don't like it, and so they attack. You know, and of course, it'd be easy for you then to single them out and attack back or whatever. So these things will go on. But all I'm trying to help you with here, and what the Buddha was pointing out, was just to understand how all of this works. And it works just like this. And to the extent that we can understand this and see this and know this, it can inform our actions in such a way that maybe we can minimize these kinds of entanglements and confusions and generation of so much pain. So to do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome. And then he says, purify your mind. And this purify your mind, it doesn't mean to hold a bunch of lofty thoughts or something like this. It just means to be watchful of the kinds of things that will come up in our mind, where we will take hold of this or that or one thing or another or our favorite thing here. And we'll, of course, we'll do all of that out of our confusion and thinking that I need to do this so that I'm pleased and protected. But if we look very carefully, you are not very pleased. and you're not protected by that. We talked about a little bit this morning, talked about this matter of being other dependent. We become other dependent rather than living and breathing and acting out of our immediate awareness of just this, where our actions now become very close to what we might call natural, except again, I don't really want to use that term. But the actions of a Buddha, of one who is awake, the actions that are coming out of wholeness. And then maybe with this, to the extent that we can begin to act out of this and speak out of this, and maybe we can help others to notice this, or to notice something about the activity that they so easily, readily get caught up in. It's easy to latch on to the idea that somehow I have to bring all of this to an end, this suffering, this muddy world of pain and suffering. But what our way is just to learn how to be here, present with all of this, in such a way that we are not creating the problem, extending the problem, continuing the problem. And not worrying too much if once in a while we do get caught up and the next thing you know we're involving ourselves with it in some way or another. All right, these things will happen. Don't beat yourself up over that. Come back to just this. This is what our practice is. It's very simple. It doesn't have an agenda beyond this concern for acting out of wholeness, acting out of an awakened mind, rather than a small, selfish, ego mind. Getting back to that question that if it was ever raised or discussed or debated, are we natural? Well, I guess at this point, maybe we could say it doesn't matter. But that's not the place to go for this discussion. If it does come up as we talk about these things, it might be helpful to realize that that isn't going to bear fruit. That isn't going to lead to something very productive. That's possible, I suppose, in some way, but not in and of itself. I think about the only way it could is for somehow to end up showing itself to be the ineffectual way to go about this, that it really is. Okay, well, maybe I said enough on that to give you some questions, or if you have some questions or concerns or arguments about what I said here. Yeah, Jed.
The teaching of watching our own mind reminds me a little bit of the conversation I saw yesterday that said, change starts with me. Just kind of a nice attitude there where it seems like that person was concerned with, you know, trying to change other people and accusing other people and just concerned with what they were doing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. Except I think we can drop the word starts. Change is me. Because everything is changing. But if we persist in our usual way, which is out of our ego, you know, then we're just going to perpetuate trouble. So yeah, it has to start with me. But that initial change is wake up. Just wake up. And now whatever actions, to the extent that you can act out of awakeness in this moment, you don't need to worry about what it is you're doing. You will be doing those things. You will be acting out of the whole. And you don't need to worry about the details of that. If you have some kind of an agenda there, you know, other than awakeness itself, or living in this way, or out of wholeness, you have some particular thing that you're grasping there that you're trying to bring across, well, be careful, because you cannot help but, yeah, you might be seeming to make progress in the direction you want to go with this, and more people are tuning in, but the tentacles are reaching out from that. And all sorts of other things come as a result of that. This is the one thing that kind of scares me when I think that I've tossed out a couple of books, well, more than a couple, I guess now, out there in the world. I did that. I want to help people out of their confusion, so I throw those out there, but I don't know. There could be entanglements of difficulty that could be coming from this. So we have to be careful. It isn't just enough to act with our good intentions. You know? Still, we have to act. But the first thing to do is to wake up, which might seem impossible or too difficult or something like that. But actually, it's not that difficult. Just look at what you're doing. Stop. It's not that hard. But you got to be serious about it. And I would say, take up this practice. And I mean, take it up. Actually, do it. Take it up. If you don't take it up, it's not that we take this up so that I will awaken. But awakening is this practice, so what are you doing? So I would say, take this up and stop with the ideas. But that's the first thing. Maybe the first and the last. But there's the change. Because it's always, there's always change. Well, this is one piece of a little change there, whatever you need to be considering. Once we wake up, then we can practice. And then we can have a discussion. But our usual way is, well, let's have a discussion. Practice, I don't know. Let's just, it's fun to have a discussion. And of course, we need to have some discussions. It's kind of what we're doing right now. But Dogen says, you know, first wake up. And practice. Well, waking up and practice, this is going to be the same thing. Now maybe you can say something. Or have a discussion. Anything else? Yeah?
Is there something more about order out of disorder?
Order out of disorder? Well, chaos theory would help you with a lot of this. But if we just look at the activity of the world, well, this actually gets involved in some pretty subtle things and has to do with the laws of nature and stuff like this. And there's a lot to be said there, and not all of it satisfying. And there's all kinds of systems, of course, but it's saying it's some kind of a physical system of, say, just material in space. You know, it just seems to be random. You know, I remember my mother once, she wondered, well, how is it that, you know, like the planets are going around the sun and the galaxies are, you know, spinning and all this. And I just said, well, if you just had a bunch of random material in space, that's what would happen. And she wanted to know why. Well, just from gravity, the stuff starts being drawn together. But why would it spin? She wanted to know. Well, it would be rather remarkable if it didn't spin, if you have stuff that's starting to draw together like this, yeah, because it would have to be so balanced, perfectly balanced, that it would all just come together and not spin. But the fact is, it's not, you know, it's random. It's, there's clumps here and there and open spaces and things like this. So as a result of that, it would have some kind of imbalance. And as it starts moving in like this, it'll be just like the skater pulling in her arms as she's, you know, spin like this, you know, and as she brings in her arms, she'll spin faster and faster. The same thing here. So as the stuff starts coming together, because it isn't quite balanced, it'll start looping around. Different elements will loop around each other and things like this, and then little curly cues out. So the whole thing is going to, whether it's a galaxy or a solar system or whatever, is going to flatten out into a disk spinning. And the elements within it will spin. So here, out of chaos, all of a sudden, we are coming into kind of an ordered system here. There was no intention behind it that we could say. It doesn't make sense to speak of this as having. But all natural systems operate in ways like this. They, you know, similar to that at least. You know, and all the order we see in nature, including the different veins in the leaves of the trees and all of this, come about as a result of this kind of activity. We think, in our hubris, our arrogance, we can just go out there and arrange the world to suit us. But we're not acting out of the whole. All of these things, I can get into that, but I won't, it'll be too much. But like the rotation of a galaxy, where it has to do with the whole, of the entire cosmos is involved in that. Because of inertia, and but I won't get into all that. So there isn't any one part that's driving it. That's why it works in the way that it does. But we're quite different than that. We'll come along and we want to improve nature. But it's kind of interesting. You know, you look at a lot of the places that we've improved. After a while, these are the kind of places we want to get away from and go out into the countryside and find some nice spot on a beautiful, pristine lake, the places that we haven't touched yet. But after a while, we'll ruin that too, and then we want to find... And why? Well, that pristine lake and all these other places and things like this, well, they were put together in a different way than what we're going to do with it. And there was a development that went on at Walden Pond some years ago now. to honor Thoreau or whatever. And they ended up putting in some huge concrete embankment or something on one side or whatever. To improve it, I guess, so that people could come and enjoy the place where Thoreau had his little hut. Oh, really? In the canyon?
No, not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is what we'll do. Of course, there's money in it, you see. And we all know. Well, I got a cartoon out here. The guy saying to us, it was a little too cynical. I almost didn't put it out there. But a guy talking to his son, and he says, "Remember, son, perception is not reality. Money is." So yeah, and we're easily seduced by money certainly, and many other things. But this isn't an invitation to sit on our hands and to not engage in activity. That's nothing that we have to, because you cannot help the whole cosmos, everything, to every atom. It's all dynamic. There already is activity. And so even if you want to somehow then remain inactive, what exactly is that? You aren't inactive. I mean, first of all, your body is still functioning, your heart is beating and all of this sort of thing. But more than that, there's stuff interacting with you. Even if you choose, if you want to be like a lump in the stream or something like this, or a stone in the stream, but everything is interacting around you, you know, in different kinds of little sandbars or whatever that will start to build up behind you and stuff like this. So you're not inactive, even though you're just sitting there. So there is no such thing as inactivity in that way. So the question then becomes, in regards to this matter of action or karma, since you can't step out of activity or action, and this was the genius of the Buddha, his profound insight, he realized that will is the determining factor here. There's action that is unwilled, and then there's action as a result of will. And that's the one that we are so much caught up in. We could say to some extent the other animals are as well, perhaps. Yeah. And for a long time, no doubt, our technology was not such that it made that much of a difference. But we have now outpaced pretty much every other species by magnitudes. I mean, it's just incredible. And that's made quite a difference for us. So this is a problem for us human beings. We want to learn about the ways of the world and how the world is and how it acts, and to live in compliance with that, and you will be happier and at peace, less blood pressure, you know, I don't know, anger, all of that, to be less of it. And not only that, but and most of all, you will know reality. You will know truth. You do know it even now. It isn't something you have to learn. You have it now. You do know this. But it's a matter of watching yourself and understand what you're doing and see all the entanglements involved in the kind of activity that we normally get ourselves caught up in. We feed off of it. And it really isn't necessary. The activity is not yours. The activity of the world is not yours. The life of the world is not yours. That is what your life is. It's the life of the world, but it's not you. But that is your life. It is the life of the world, the whole dynamic, the whole. But until we wake up to that and see that, we're going to be fighting with it in some way. And then when it comes to this matter of global warming and doing all the kind of the silent and slow but pervasive and immense destructive things that we do, these will not come about if we were to all wake up. But of course, that's not in your hands either. But you can wake up. And out of this awakeness where you really understand this, you might be able to help others. Yeah, Liz.
There's a story, but I'm wondering if it's not about the kind of, just maybe if the teaching about that kind of will action or living our fullness. It's the Buddha story where he's on the plains and a king or a ruler comes and there's going to be a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes once and it the Buddha is able to work through it and he goes away. And the second time he comes again, the ruler, and there's not a resolution.
The battle has already started.
Yeah.
When he got there.
And is that the kind of story of living out of the hole and being aware?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's not such a hard story.
It is.
As you picture,
you want to do something and you want him to do something.
Yeah.
You know. But, the story is that, and it's his own country, I guess, his own homeland or whatever, and another king was invading, a general was invading with his army, and heading toward the place of where the Buddhist people were, you know, his kinsmen, that sort of thing, and so you'd think he'd have a personal stake in this, you know. Anyway, the Buddha finds the king and his army, leading his armies, were coming along this road, and the Buddha knew he was coming along that way, so he went there and he sat under a dead tree, the Buddha did. Just sat down under a dead tree. And of course the king coming along and he sees a man sitting under a dead tree. It's kind of odd, out in the hot sun, you know. So he stopped and he said, "Why are you sitting under this dead tree?" He says, "There's all these lush, green, shady trees over here. You could, you know, why are you under this dead tree?" And the Buddha said, because this tree grew in my native land. Something to that effect. And it touched the general's heart, and he turned around and he left. But then later, there's a lot to this story, but then other people talked him into attacking once again. In the meantime, the Buddha moved on, you know, as he always kind of traveled around or whatever. Now he is sort of out of the region when the general comes back to attack once again. And this time when they get hold of the Buddha and they bring him there, of course, remember, this isn't the days of jets and even automobiles. It was, you know, slow getting around. By the time the Buddha got there, and he was on a hill overlooking the plain where the battle was already engaged. And they were slaughtering the Buddha's people, that sort of thing. And so they said, "Well, go out and, you know, do something." And the Buddha said, "This isn't the time." There wasn't anything he could do at that moment in the heat of the battle. That's the other thing, too. We might get into conflicts and things with people in regards to this concern that we have, say, with global warming. Be careful. You get into the heat of the argument. Just watch that carefully. You don't have to win that right now. And start to get some understanding maybe of how it is that people will attach to particular views, even views that are hurtful to them, but they don't know it. Or even sometimes when they do know it, but they've so identified with it, they can't. You know, so there's all kinds of complications there. It'd be helpful to get some sense of that. But the Buddha understood in this moment that there was nothing he could do. And then, as it was, then somebody told the general after they had killed all the adults in the village or wherever the place was, then he said, well, you better kill the children because they're going to grow up and they're going to hate you and they'll come after you and that sort of thing. And so the general ordered his men to go and slaughter the children. And the Buddha was observing all this, and people that were there with him, no, you must do something now. But he said, no, even now, there was nothing to be done at this moment. So you might be in a situation, the wisdom would be to know when and how you can speak or act, and there's other times and maybe there is nothing in this moment that can be done about this particular issue now, in this moment. But it's to act out of that, and you can do that if you're seeing this in totality, seeing it in the whole. So there could be moments that are extremely painful, but the Buddha knew for him now to act out of anger, to just attack, to basically carry on in the same way that the general was acting, it isn't going to work. That will just perpetuate the problem. And of course, even in the case of the general, it was bad calculation there, because even if you do slaughter all the children, you haven't slaughtered everybody who have some concern about these people that you've now killed. And it is going to perpetuate the trouble. But we see in various ways the same kind of thing being carried out in the world today. I mean, it's just been with us as human beings from time immemorial. But what are we going to do about this? Well, the first thing is to wake up. Because there isn't any particular formula. There isn't any pat answer. Do this under these circumstances. But if you're awake and you are in whatever the circumstances might be that we can't lay out ahead of time, to the extent that you're awake, if there is something to be done, you're in a better position to see what that is. And then you can go ahead and do that. But often it might mean, at this moment, as painful as it is, there's nothing to be done. We have to realize we can't always bring the moment, to whatever the situation is, to some happy ending or closure that we would be satisfied with. But it is a matter of just seeing the circumstances that we're in. Anything else? Yes.
I was reading something the other day that kind of is exactly on topic here with the environment, but it was interesting because it compared what we do to ourselves as what we do to the environment. You know, we fill our bodies.
Wait, it compares. What was the first?
What we do to ourselves. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we fill our bodies with poison, we fill our bodies with negativity, you know, our minds with anger, resentment, things like that. We do that to the world. We fill the air with poison, the water with poison, and kind of like you were saying, until we wake up. Start our own house cleaning and are getting rid of all those things to build with compassion and love, mm-hmm. You know, then we can stretch out and do that to our world. That's
yeah.
Exactly. And I completely butchered the eloquent way of explaining that. Sorry, I said that, but mm-hmm. In a nutshell,
yeah, it just has to start with right here where we are and just wake up right here. But don't be too concerned about bringing it out there into the world. Be careful about that, because the next thing we'll do will be setting out some kind of agenda there and want to bring about particular ends and that sort of thing. That's where we'll go wrong. We should just trust that if we're just here and we're living completely out of this moment, whatever it is that we're encountering, we will be able to engage that in a way that might be helpful, wholesome. So it, in a way, it takes less energy to be more effective. But it is hard to see that at times. And there's times when yeah, you really want to do something, but maybe there's nothing to be done. So I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah. Anything else? Well, I guess we've just about used up the hour. Any second now. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.